Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, an early Al-Qaeda operative and personal associate of Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who later became one of the West's most tied-in spies. We'll talk this hour with Eamon Dean. He grew up in Saudi Arabia and defined himself from an early age as a jihadist, fighting in Bosnia, the Philippines, and Afghanistan. He also built a reputation within Al-Qaeda as a skilled bomb maker. But when Dean discovered the group was targeting innocent civilians for terrorist activities, he realized he'd been fighting based on a lie and was recruited to spy for British intelligence. We'll talk with him about how his beliefs formed and changed and about what it might take to get other people to turn their backs on terrorism. Our conversation starts after a short break. From early in his life, Eamon Dean had a dream to wage jihad in support of his faith. Radicalized as a teenager, he joined Al-Qaeda and fought in Bosnia, Afghanistan, the Philippines, and elsewhere, ready and willing to die for his cause. But the more tied in he got, the more he realized acts of terrorism perpetrated on innocent people were not the apex of devotion, but the antithesis. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. While Eamon Dean was a highly connected member of Al-Qaeda, he also became an informant for the British intelligence services MI5 and MI6, feeding information to the West in hopes of preventing further bloodshed. It's an astonishing story he shares in his new memoir, which was written with journalists Tim Lister and Paul Cruikshank. The book is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. He joins us from the studios of the BBC in London to talk about it. Eamon, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What role did your faith play in the way you were raised as a Bahraini kid living in Saudi Arabia?
It was important. I mean, basically, faith was an essential part of my upbringing because in earlier stages, I lost my father when I was 4, and then later, when I was 12, my mother passed away, and that more or less caused me to seek meaning and answers, and basically I turned to scripture, to Muslim scripture, basically, in order to find meaning and answers. And I was, an avid reader of books written by Muslim thinkers and Muslim ideologues.
Your education included the Islamic Awareness Circle, which you describe as kind of like a scout troop with religion at the core. How important was that in how you developed your identity?
Well, it develops a sort of camaraderie, and it prepares you for a life where religious affiliation was far more important than any other affiliation you have, more than either school affiliation or job affiliation, or even at that point even national affiliation. So I felt more part of the wider global Muslim community than basically being a Saudi or a Bahraini at that time.
You were warned in the Islamic Awareness Circle that a cartoon show like The Smurfs, which I guess was translated, was forbidden. Looking back, do you feel like that was inappropriate? Or, I wonder if you started to see the world in really in terms that made a lot of things seem frightening to you.
Well, of course. I mean, actually, even when that religious instructor was telling us basically that the Smurfs, against our faith, and basically it is corrupting our view of the world. But in fact, I mean, I love the Smurfs. I just saw them for what they were, cute entertainment. Then I thought, no, I mean, I shouldn't let someone basically tell me, what is permissible to watch and what is not, as long as it was an innocent fun.
Did you realize how unusual you were? I mean, I guess you were an incredibly smart kid, and you could digest religious scholarship that was would have seemed beyond your years for most other kids.
I would say, to an extent, I was the youngest member of the Awareness Circle, and yet, basically, I was one of those who used to win trophies for them, intellectual competitions, and even in oratory competitions and poetry competitions. So basically, yes, I mean, it was kind of strange. I used to get lots of praise from my fellow Awareness Circle members. But at the same time, basically, they used to tell me, just don't get your head too inflated, be grounded.
How did did you start to view Islam as being persecuted by the modern world?
I think when I started at the age of 12, just after my mother passed away, mm-hmm. when I started reading the writings of Sayyid Qutb, he's an Egyptian thinker who was executed in Egypt in 1966. So, you know, years and years and years after he died, I was actually reading his writings on interpretation of the Quran. And because he wrote those interpretations of the Quran when he was in prison for 9 years, and so he was writing from the point of view of pain. He was writing through his own experience with pain, with solitude and with grief. And so it appealed to me, I think, because I was going through the same grief in a sense, because I just lost my moral compass, who, you know, was my mother. And later also, one of my own teachers in the school, a math teacher who came from a very affluent family in Saudi Arabia, went alongside one member of the Bahraini royal family to Bosnia to fight, and he died there. And so when we were told of his death in our own classroom, I felt basically that the Bosnian conflict, you know, which was raging thousands of miles away, just became a reality in our own classroom.
So you were just 16 when you decided to go fight in Bosnia. Do you think had your mother lived that she would have discouraged that?
I think she would have locked me up and made sure basically I'll never see my passport again.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, no mother would allow that, especially mine. And that's why, you know, whenever someone asked me the question, if your mother was alive, do you think you would have gone? And I would have said, usually I say yes. You know, I wouldn't have gone, actually. I would have stayed. Mm. But the fact that I had somewhat of a, some personal freedom to move around and to go around, I felt that maybe I had an obligation more on me, you know, to go and fight rather than those who have familial obligations.
What did jihad mean to you, and who did you think was a fair fighting adversary?
At the time, for me, the jihad meant the defense of civilians who are facing genocide or ethnic cleansing, and that was Bosnia at that time. Mm. There was no question. The UN, United Nations basically classified the Bosnian conflict as a genocide against the civilian population because of their faith. And it wasn't only just the Muslim Bosnians who were facing that ethnic cleansing and genocide. Also the Catholic Croats, were their neighbors basically, were facing the same thing from the Serbs. And so that's why I decided to go. Except I think the war was sold to us, through the propaganda that the jihadists in Bosnia were putting out as a war between Islam and Christianity. Because the Serbs, even though they were fighting a nationalistic war, they were cloaking that, their conflict with heavily with Christian symbology. And that's why it was sold to us as a crusade. And therefore, basically, we must fight to push back this crusade. And that's exactly why I thought it was a duty to go, and I went.
It's so interesting because you fought enthusiastically. You were willing to die for your cause, but you did realize even at 16, 17, 18, that war and religious hatred are just incredibly destructive.
At that time, yes. Because, you see, at the beginning of the conflict, when I went there, I was just, wide-eyed, innocent, bespectacled, geeky young boy from Saudi Arabia. And by the end of the war, I just realized basically how far, myself and my comrades basically went down the path of darkness. In the beginning, whenever we used to take prisoners from the Serbian militias, we used to say, great, now we can exchange them for the civilians who are held in the death camps, in Bosnia. And, we were happy about it. But then by the end of the war, massacres happened against those prisoners because basically, unfortunately, my fellow jihadists became full of rage and hate, and the war basically darkened their souls. And I think many people who've been to war before will understand this, will understand how, after more than a year of constant combat and fighting, and seeing atrocities committed by all sides, by the way, you start to feel disconnected sometime from normal, ordinary life.
I would imagine, too, that your anger is also fueled by seeing the people that you cared about get hurt and die.
Well, that's one part of it. And I think for me, In fact, basically seeing the people who came with me to Bosnia to fight and die. In fact, I know this mentality might be strange, but actually seeing them die and seeing them dead more or less filled my heart with some sort of jealousy at the time. I felt basically that they were worthy in the eyes of God of martyrdom and I wasn't. I know it's a strange, you know, concept. Even I find it alien now after all these years. But nonetheless, that's how exactly, you know, how exactly I felt at that time. That those who gave their lives for a cause like this, you know, were the worthy ones, and I'm the one who survived. I'm not the worthy one. Survival, you know, meant shame rather than something to celebrate.
So you weren't suicidal, but you were really eager for martyrdom. You went from place to place, continuing the fight in search, possibly, at the time you thought of the ultimate sacrifice of your own life.
Absolutely. I mean, you think of it as a journey, a path, a way to, you know, for redemption, a way for forgiveness, a way also for serving my faith and serving my, in a global Muslim community. That's how I thought of it at that time. I didn't think basically it will lead, you know, to far more disastrous and catastrophic consequences.
So you did fight, but your commanders also realized you were like really good at math. You had technological skills. What kind of work did they start training you to do?
Well, at the beginning, they realized that, you know, I'm good with mortars, and so basically I could easily, you know, calculate if something goes wrong, basically where to fire and how to fire, and, you know, get the exact coordinates. And I think that's, and map reading also was something I excelled in. And in later life, when I ended up in Afghanistan, you know, I was, you know, sent, you know, to a specialist camp, a small one, to become a bomb maker.
So at the time that you got involved with Al-Qaeda, was this just an outgrowth of the fighting that you had done overseas? Is it a kind of a formalized process by which you sign on with the organization?
No, because for me, Al-Qaeda was still an alien concept by the time I was leaving Afghanistan, but I was leaving Bosnia. But however, near the end of the war in Bosnia, a visitor came to, you know, to see us and to visit the Mujahideen Brigade in Bosnia. His name was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who many of your listeners would recognize as the mastermind of 9/11. He came there because he wanted to see what kind of talented jihadist this conflict you know, produced. And he really did get, you know, some really good talented people to work with him. Ramzi bin Ashib, his, you know, second hand, you know, right hand man, basically, was, he met him there in Bosnia. And many of the future leaders of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda in Yemen, actually, were graduates of the Bosnian conflict. So when he came to see us there, he told us, look, you know, why do we allow the enemy to dictate where we fight? You know, we're fighting in Bosnia, then in Chechnya, and then somewhere else. We're running from one conflict to another on the fringes of the Muslim world. No, what we need to do is to strengthen the center of the Muslim world by toppling the Arab regimes who are backed up by the US. And the only way we can do that is by expelling the US out of the Middle East altogether. So we may topple these governments, create the caliphate, you know, the Muslim empire, and then strengthen the center so the fringes of the Muslim world will never be subject to genocide and ethnic cleansing. That's his vision, and that's what he wanted us, you know, to do. So we told him, okay, so if the nature of the conflict is changing, what do you want us to do? Where should we go? And he said, Afghanistan, the camps are reopening, and therefore, if you go there, you will get training that is suitable for the nature of the conflict that will follow.
So it felt to you like that was the place to be. You needed to be in Afghanistan if you were going to really fulfill what you thought was the right thing to do.
Yes, and also it helped that, you know, most of my fellow jihadists were going there too. So mm-hmm. It was more or less a group psyche taking over. And so, you know, if this is where the flock is flying to, I'm going to fly with them.
My guest is Ayman Dean, a consultant on security and counterterrorism now for governments and the private sector. His memoir is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Eamon Dean, a former Al-Qaeda operative who later became a double agent feeding information to the British intelligence services MI5 and MI6. He's now a consultant on security and counterterrorism for the private sector and for governments. And his book is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Eamon, you already mentioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You also had interactions with Osama bin Laden. Can you help us understand what made him so charismatic?
Well, the fact that he was a symbol. He was viewed by everyone, basically, as a symbol of the cause, because he could have had a rich, you know, wonderful, comfortable life in Saudi Arabia, but yet he abandoned all of that and lived like a hermit in Afghanistan for the sake of his cause. He, you know, was soft-spoken. His, physical, height, like he was really tall. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the fact he was always, whenever he, you talk to him, you feel as if he is giving you his full undivided attention and that he cares. That's what made him, more or less a symbol. But the problem was, he wasn't the one who made all the decisions. It was the group of Egyptian operatives, around him, basically, who to this day runs the affairs of Al-Qaeda.
So do you feel like a lot of loyalty from within the organization was to bin Laden specifically, as opposed to the broader organization and its mission?
I think it was a mix of both. It helped, basically, that he was there. And he was a unifying figure for many of the jihadist factions within Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, Al-Qaeda itself and its broader aims, basically, what attracted many people to its ranks. I remember bin Laden himself was telling me and, saying to anyone, basically, who would join the group, that this war is going to last a generation, two, three. It's not going to, it's going to outlive us. We will not live to see the end of it. But at the end of the day, we will see the caliphate restored by the grace of God, within two or three generations.
So bin Laden projected this kind of calm authority. Abu Zubaydah, on the other hand, was menacing even to the people working with him.
Oh, yes, he was. I mean, and I still remember, at some stage, I became seriously ill with, a simultaneous typhoid and malaria, hitting me at the same time. Mm. And at that time, basically, he abandoned all pretense of being tough, person. And he was exceptionally, worried about me and, very caring. And he was basically telling, making sure I, got the best treatment possible to make sure I don't die. So when I asked him, I said, basically, okay, you're being very nice to me, but you're always tough with everyone else. And he said, look, I'm dealing here with people who, if you are not tough with them, they will just take you for a ride. And therefore, it's important that, that I keep this persona. But otherwise, even though he was instrumental in, being the gatekeeper for the jihadist groups operating in Afghanistan, including Al-Qaeda, yet he had his softer side.
So Al-Qaeda chose you for a mission to London because you had pretty good English skills. What was the first thing they asked you to do when you got there in, I think it was 1998?
Well, my mission basically was to pick up communication equipment, satellite phones and, radios. So that's what I was supposed to do. And it wasn't only the English skills. I remember they told me that we want you to go because you have the least suspicious face. because I remember I said, what do you mean by least suspicious? They said, okay, how many times people stop you on the road to ask you for a direction, or they give you their camera and say, please, take a picture? And I said, well, quite a few times. And they said, that's exactly, people trust you. So immigration officers will not think, about stopping you or anything. They will just wave you through. And that's exactly what we need. We need someone basically who just look innocent and that's exactly who you are. And so that's why they chose me.
Did that bother you? Did you want to look really tough and scary?
No, I didn't mind. Generally speaking, basically, I'm I like the fact basically that people think I'm kind. And I remember even Al-Qaeda, I remember, you know, in one of the training courses, you know, it was a training course on raiding a building, taking hostages. So by the end of it, basically, they said to me, you know, the instructor said to me, never, ever participate in hostage taking. You're so kind. You will end up releasing them and giving them money for the taxi even. So never be in that situation, you know. And so, which, you know, more or less it was their own way of telling me basically that my moral compass was, you know, pointing the right direction somehow. And that's what saved me in the end.
So in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda launched suicide attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. These were really troubling for you.
Very much so, because that was really the opening salvo, the first shot in this conflict that Al-Qaeda would embroil the Muslim world in with the United States. And hearing about the theory, you know, of how we will liberate the so-called Muslim world from the U.S. influence was something, and seeing it applied in reality is something else. Suddenly, everything is brought into sharp focus. You know, where are we going? Where are we heading? You know, the fact that we're killing civilians in large numbers just to get at few Americans who are diplomats to begin with, and then twisting the justification for this attack, citing religious edicts from 800 years ago that bears no resemblance whatsoever to how they were applied in the case of the American embassies in Nairobi and Tanzania. I think that troubled me so much. I saw exactly where we're heading, and that we were going into a dark, dark place where, you know, it's not going to be, you know, just the U.S. who would be attacked, but also our own governments, our own security forces, our own relatives who work in these governments and these security forces. So it's going to be a civil war within Islam. No, I thought I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't, you know, participate in this. I thought, okay, my fellow jihadists are going somewhere where I can't follow them, and therefore I'm leaving.
I can't imagine how agonizing that would be, to have gone from having like this total, what felt like complete moral clarity at 16 to just a few years later realizing that it was not built on a solid foundation.
Because at 16, the enemy was wearing military uniform. They were in the mountains. We were in front lines, defined front lines, outside of the cities and outside of the villages. I mean, we see them, they see us. You know, they were in their tanks and we were in our own, you know, tanks. I mean, this is different, however. Seeing people in heavily populated area, you know, 220 of them dying and 5,000 wounded, and 150 of these 5,000 were blinded for life. It's just too much, you know, to stomach. And this is when you think that this is not what I signed up for.
Did you make any attempt to discuss your doubts with other people that you knew within Al-Qaeda in hopes of shifting their focus to attacks, away from attacks that would affect civilians?
Well, I mean, once you are in Al-Qaeda, I mean, it's not like, for example, that we have a debating society there where,
right.
You know, you don't have an opinion and counter opinion. What you have there is an opinion and a supporting opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and a more radical opinion, but there is no counter opinion.
So what was it like for you living in London?
Well, I mean, through many twists and turns, I ended up basically, you know, working for the UK intelligence services, and they really did quite a good job in, you know, putting together a cover story, a very good cover story as to why I was in London, and details are in the book anyway of how they did it. But of course, it was, you know, something where I thought, you know, an eye-opening experience, because I always saw these people as the enemy. But, you know, after several sitting with them and several sessions with them, basically, they don't seem the enemy at all. In fact, basically, I started laughing with them. I started basically, you know, telling jokes and, you know, feeling that, you know, that they were so approachable and so decent and so good. And I just started to realize, basically, that there is far more in common between us as humans than I ever, you know, imagined before. This moral clarity, black and white, that we are, you know, the noble people, they are the enemies, they are the blood-sucking vampires, sucking the blood of the Muslim world, you know, stealing our oil. All of this just started to dissolve slowly, leaving in its place something else, something completely different, where I just realized that that I was part of a group that tried to undermine nation states that are the building blocks of this modern world. And I thought that what the intelligence services in the UK were trying to teach me there, basically, and trying to instill in me was the understanding of how law and order, safety and security were far more paramount than the pursuit of political ideals and empire building. And that's coming from the British, who themselves were empire builders.
What role did you play in Al-Qaeda's 9/11 preparations?
Well, many people ask this question, and they say basically that, you know, in the months, you know, up to 9/11, basically, you were a spy inside Al-Qaeda. How come you didn't spot it? And the answer was basically because Al-Qaeda was based in Afghanistan, a black hole of information, and it was a very siloed organization. So if you are in WMD, which I was in the bomb making and the chemical weapons and explosives research and biological weapons. So that was my silo. And external operations was a silo. Finance was a silo. And internal operations were a silo. So being in the WMD, you know, program and reporting on it and understanding the shape of it, I did not see at all basically what was happening in external operation or in finance. The irony is that if I was in the finance part of Al-Qaeda, all it would have taken is for me to receive one instruction to say, send this money to one of the you know, hijackers in the US. And that's it. The first thread of unraveling the entire plot would have happened. But I wasn't part of the finance. And this is the problem with spying. I mean, basically, you need at least, you know, several spies inside the organization in each of the silos in order to prevent something like 9/11. The only thing, I just got a hint of it when 3 months before the attacks, I was on my way back to London from Afghanistan, and I was summoned by Bin Laden's deputy. And he told me that since I'm going to be in London very soon, there are 4 individuals in the UK who need to be warned that they need to leave the UK and come to Afghanistan before the end of August, and that they need to do that very quickly and very swiftly. And then he told me that something big might happen, and if it happens and the Americans are here in Afghanistan, do not be tempted to come and join the jihad with us. Stay where you are and we will contact you. So of course, as soon as I arrived back in the UK, I alerted my MI5 and MI6 handlers of this conversation and this ominous message. And of course, you know, that's when my intelligence, and of course intelligence coming from other sources, started, you know, the red, you know, bulb, you know, blinking in US intelligence circles that something is about to happen. But there was no way of knowing the nature of it. This is the problem.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Eamon Dean, now a consultant on security and counterterrorism. He was a member of Al-Qaeda before he became a spy. His book is called 9 Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Was there ever anybody you suspected who was also in Al-Qaeda that you suspected might have their doubts, but as you made it clear, it was sort of impossible to go around asking questions and debating these things. But did you ever wonder about people you worked with?
Well, I mean, you always wonder if there are any other double agents there. You know, and one of the ironies is that basically I was given a course within Al-Qaeda on security, you know, not just only counter-interrogation, you know, in foreign airports or foreign lands, but also on counter-intelligence to spot, you know, potential spies. And I was thinking, how ironic. I mean,
too late. Right.
Yes. But in reality, the problem is once you're a spy, you're too conscious. You don't want to ask questions. And that's the first rule of spying. Never ask questions. You know, let the information naturally come into you. Because, you know, throughout my time inside Al-Qaeda, you know, five times that people were apprehended for being spies, you know, on behalf of either Jordanian or Egyptian intelligence services, and they were executed. So it was no joke. I mean, and your first mistake is your last mistake. You will never live to, you know, to make another mistake. So that's why it was important that I do not ask any questions, which basically is counterintuitive in espionage, but unfortunately you have to do it.
What kind of relationship did you have with your British handlers?
I view them as friends. To this day, I basically, like, you know, I view them as friends. I mean, they were exceptionally friendly, they were sympathetic, and they always emphasized the fact that do not take risks. I mean, they absolutely were always terrified of losing me. Every time, basically, I just go into Afghanistan, you know, they, you know, I'm considered to be a lost, you know, behind enemy lines. As soon as I come out, you know, I'm born again. So that's why they were always relieved whenever they heard my voice on the phone saying I'm out, so we can arrange the next meeting or the next flight. And also, basically, my cover story, which basically was a brilliant one, is that I partnered with some members of Al-Qaeda to do some, you know, food and spice business. So we, you know, exported from Afghanistan and Pakistan into other areas of the Middle East. That was excellent. That gave me the excuse to be out. And also, at the same time, please, these members of Al-Qaeda, they were getting some money for it.
So the British compensated you somewhat for working with them, but there was only so much money they could give you because it would become really obvious to Al-Qaeda if you had all this extra cash all of a sudden.
Indeed. I mean, basically, it was, you know, let's put it this way, basically. I mean, you know, an assistant teacher in a primary school in the US might make far more than what I used to do at that time. So, you know, the compensation really happened after, you know, my time ended, and they made sure basically I found a good job. I mean, basically, they made sure that I exchanged one form of terrorism to another. You know, I went into banking.
Were you afraid that you would be found out? How much time did you spend worrying about that?
Nothing, never. Like, you know, basically, I just repressed it so much, you know, to the point where, you know, I believed myself to be more of a jihadist, actually, you know, there than the jihadists themselves. I mean, I just repressed the spy within me to the point that, you know, no longer there. The only conscious link between myself and my, you know, and the spy within me was the fact that I was detailing and memorizing all the, you know, all the conversations I was having and all the names I'm seeing and all the faces I'm encountering and all the information I'm just collecting. That's the only thing, basically, I was doing. I can't write anything. I can't register anything. I can't. So, yeah.
Former Al-Qaeda member turned double agent Eamon Dean is my guest. His book is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or, of course, we're on Twitter @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former Al-Qaeda member turned double agent for British intelligence, Eamon Dean. His book is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You got word of plans in the works for a chemical attack on the New York City subway system.
Yes, that was in late 2002 and early 2003, and I immediately alerted my handlers for on it. And I remember their expression, basically. I mean, they were really horrified. And I remember they told me, basically, that, you know, when I gave them the diagrams and how it works and all of that, and then, of course, basically, along with their CIA colleagues, they constructed the device, they tested it, and they realized it is lethal. And that's when they told me to stay on top of this plot to make sure that, you know, we have all the relevant information on it. Then, you know, that plot was actually done by Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia. However, Al-Qaeda Central, you know, led by Amin Zawahiri at the time on behalf of Osama bin Laden, stopped the plot because, you know, the timing wasn't right. Not because basically they thought that it was the wrong thing to do, but for them, they believed the timing wasn't right. The U.S. was about to invade Iraq, and they did not want to give the Americans the pretext that they wanted that, yes, look, chemical terrorism, chemical weapons in the hands of terrorists, that's exactly why we have to invade Iraq. Zawahiri said at that time that if we do it, the Muslim world will never forgive us for giving George Bush, you know, the pretext that he desperately needed. So that's why it was stopped. However, they, you know, 18 months later, they wanted to use it again against the U.S. Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, against the U.S. personnel there.
You know, I have to tell you, Eamon, books like this are so interesting to me because not only do they, I think, in a really helpful way, kind of make people within terrorist organizations, it helps us to understand that they're human beings, which is not to excuse, you know, murderous things that are being done, but it helps to kind of demystify people. I wonder if you can tell us day to day, what is it like to be a member of Al-Qaeda if you are not, you know, living overseas, but if you're living and working alongside these people? I mean, do they come in and talk about what they had for dinner last night? Is it not so different from any other job, except that the intentions are really different?
Well, I mean, our lives there basically was almost like, you know, Boy Scouts, you know, basically in the mountains. It was full of, you know, I know some listeners might be, you know, disturbed by this, but it was full of sweetness and tenderness. I mean, people, like, you know, were friendly to each other. We were always having, you know, lessons about history, about politics. We were, you know, watching the news recorded for us, you know, on videotapes and brought from across Pakistan into Afghanistan. We were having meals, we were having training, we were having sports, we were playing volleyball. You know, one of our favorite, you know, games there were volleyball, or we will go into the lakes and the rivers in Afghanistan and swim in them. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, there was you know, element of fun, an element of camaraderie, an element of brotherhood. You know, it's almost like a monastic order. We were thinking of ourselves as warrior monks. So some people might say, well, excuse me, I mean, you know, you're talking about murderers here. And I say, yes, because you see, when people say, oh, you know, we are humanizing, well, actually, human nature is capable of extreme love as well as extreme evil. And when we say they are humans, well, of course, humans are capable of the worst atrocities as well as capable of great acts of charity. And that's why when you see Islamic terrorists, they are capable of both. They are full of love and tenderness and sweetness towards their fellow jihadists, but they are extremely vicious and violent towards their perceived enemies. That's why they are called extremists, because they operate within the both extreme spectrums here, extreme love and extreme hate.
So what do we do about that? What do we do with that? Is there a way to harness that capacity for extreme love and tenderness to help people recognize that this violence is not the way to achieve their ends?
You have to install seeds of doubt in their mind. You know, doubt was how my journey from that darkness and from that dark place started. You know, when you, you know, try to undermine, you know, what, you know, people believe in to be the right thing to do. A jihadist weapon is 100% certainty that what he's doing is absolutely right, and that once he dies, he will go to heaven straight and God will reward him for it. But if we cause them to question what they're doing, to tell them basically that the people you're killing, whether they are women, children, young, innocent, that they will be standing in line in front of God on that day, and they will be asking you in front of God, why did you kill us? And you have to answer for that. If we tell them that no, there will be no red carpet to heaven, instead there will be severe questioning, and you have to answer for every drop of blood you've shed, maybe then we can start this journey towards, abandoning this path.
All right, let's go to the phone. We have Jeff on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Okay, I'd like a comment and then a question. First of all, I'm old, and when I was born in England, and when I came to the United States in the 50s, after I'd been here about 5 or 6 years, I was active in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and I was recruited two times by the FBI to be a spy for them, which I refused at the time. And listening to Eamon Dean, I'm glad I did. I'd like to thank him for all the risks that he's taken in his lifetime, and he's my fourth favorite Muslim. My first favorite is the Muslim journalist that threw a shoe at George W. Bush.
All right, I'm gonna stop you there, Jeff, just because we're running out of time till the end of the hour. Thank you very much. Do you hear, Eamon, from a lot of people who say, "Hey, thank you for risking your life"?
Yes, I do. And surprisingly, even for many Muslims. I mean, and that was extremely encouraging. I thought basically that, you know, I will be called a traitor or they will hate me for it. But in fact, many of them now, after all these years of conflicts in the Middle East and the death and destruction brought on by Al-Qaeda, and the fact that Al-Qaeda gave birth to ISIS, which is even a more ugly incarnation, you know, people started to realize that enough is enough. And people, were supporting me, actually.
You write that your faith in God has never been stronger. Why do you think God allows people to believe they're doing his bidding when, in fact, they're justifying violence?
Well, you see, at the end of the day, God in his infinite wisdom would, you know, test us all. Mm. And one of the way he tests us basically is to see if we follow his commandment in order to do good, or follow his commandment in order to do evil. You see, there is a verse in the Quran which says that the worst of people who do evil are those who think they are doing good. So sometime basically, you know, you are on the path of evil thinking you're doing good, and that's the worst kind of evil.
How was your cover blown?
Ah, that's an interesting story. Because of intelligence I provided to the UK, of course, basically will end up in the US, shared with the US, as both the UK and the US are great allies. Unfortunately, some of that intelligence found its way into the desk of a journalist in the US who wrote a book about it. And 46 pages of that book were devoted to a spy inside Al-Qaeda who provided the U.S. with warning about the U.S. subway, the New York subway plot, the attack against the U.S. Fifth Fleet, and other pieces of intelligence that I'm the only common denominator between them.
Hmm.
That intelligence most likely have come from the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. And the idea basically was, you know, that the Bush administration at the time wanted to demonstrate that they are not relying only on electronic means to intercept Al-Qaeda's plots, but also they have human spies inside. But I wasn't spying for the Americans. I was spying for the British, who, you know, gracefully would, you know, share that with the Americans and in confidentiality. So unfortunately, when that leaked, and they even used my first real name. I mean, out of thousands of Arabic names, they decided only to use my first real name, and that felt not a coincidence. So that more or less undermined my ability to continue. Al-Qaeda worked out very quickly, basically, that I was the one.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I can't imagine, Eamon, how terrifying it is. Like, is your heart just pounding in your ears, and are you nauseated when you suddenly realize that you've been discovered, you've been outed?
Well, yes, but you know, I think the surroundings, of where that happened helped me a lot. I was in Paris on a holiday, for the first holiday ever as a normal human being, and it was ruined, by U.S. intelligence leak. Nonetheless, you know, I was angry, but at the same time, you know, on the train back to London, to meet my handlers, I started to feel some sense of relief. I mean, I've been undercover for 7.5 years. And if there are any people who worked undercover listening, basically will understand that this is just too long, for that to take place. And it has its own toll on your, physical health as well as mental health. And therefore, I thought, well, in my opinion, basically God telling me it's time to just, take a different direction.
It must have been hard to have to lie to your loved ones as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember it was much later in life, in 2010, 4 years after my cover was blown. I still insisted to my family, oh, this is all nonsense. Al-Qaeda's fatwa was, on my head, basically was just their desperation to cover up their failures. But, when I finally, confessed to one of my brothers, who was my dearest one, the one older than me straight away, and I told him, actually, well, it was really the case, I did spy. And then he looked at me and he said, so all of your defense of your participation in Al-Qaeda, all of our pleas with you, please leave this path, never be part of it, all of the things basically you've done, So all of it basically was lie. And I said, yes. And he said, well, I need to go to the next, you know, video shop or whatever, buy a fake Oscar and give it to you, because really it was a stellar performance. So I thought that was they took it nicely.
So your family was saying, get out of Al-Qaeda. You said, no, I'm really into Al-Qaeda. And it turned out you were working against Al-Qaeda all along.
Not only that, I was actually, when I was defending Al-Qaeda, I was almost in tears. Like, I was so, you know, immersed into it, you know, defending it so passionately, because I told you, I repressed the spy within me.
Right. You stress that it's Muslims, not Western governments, that need to win the battle of ideas. Can you talk about how Muslims can do that and whether there is progress being made? Of course, I think everybody listening understands that the vast majority of Muslims in the world are peaceful and don't support terrorism. Are they having inroads with the small minority of people who do think terrorism is the way to achieve their goals?
Well, I mean, what's happening in the Muslim world right now, basically, is a civil war.
Yeah.
In a civil war between the nation states, the modern nation state, whether they are Egypt or Saudi Arabia or, Pakistan or Indonesia or whatever, and the transnational ideologies like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Hezbollah and Taliban, all of these groups who want to undermine the nation state. They don't believe in borders, in citizenships, in national identity. They don't believe in the nation state as a concept and as an institution. They want to undermine it. So basically they can create their pan-Muslim empire according to their own extremist radical vision. You see, this is where the war is happening. So the only way we can win this war is by strengthening the nation states. You know, that the nation state is the only guarantor of peace, security, safety, stability, law and order. Only then we could win this battle against the extremists who really do not care about national identity whatsoever.
When people ask you about your career and you just have 30 seconds to answer, do you have a shorthand answer about like what you do for a living?
Well, I always tell them basically I'm in financial risk management.
And that I guess that keeps people satisfied. Do you feel safe today?
When I joined Jihad, I accepted the risks. It will be hypocritical of me if I do not accept the risks right now. There are risks always, but, I put my faith in God. He kept me safe so far. I'm full of faith in him that he will never let me down.
Ayman Dean is a former explosives producer for Al-Qaeda, then double agent, now a consultant on security and counterterrorism for the private sector and for governments. His memoir is called Nine Lives, My Time as the West's Top Spy Inside Al-Qaeda. Ayman, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. We had Alan Roberts running the board today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Any podcast app will have the Think podcast, or you can go to our website where there's also information about upcoming shows and some bios. That's think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.